Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Today, I'm pleased to have as my guest Ian Rankin, the author of the best-selling Inspector Rebus series. Today, we'll be discussing Flesh Market Alley, the 15th in the Rebus series, published by Little Brown, currently available in bookstores. And to begin the interview, I've asked Mr. Rankin to read the first page of Flesh Market Alley, because in the first page, I think he does what all good writers do. He tells us a little bit about the story, and he pulls us in with the plot. And as soon as he's done reading the first page, we'll discuss what makes it so special. So without anything further from me, I give you Ian Rankin.
The past 8 years had seen itself reorganized. As a result, it no longer boasted a CID office, meaning Rebus and his fellow detectives had been cast adrift, shipped out to other stations. He'd ended up at Gayfield Square, just off Leith Walk, a cushy number, according to some. Gayfield Square was on the periphery of the elegant new town, behind whose 18th and 19th century facades anything could be happening without those outside being any the wiser. It certainly felt a long way from Knoxland, further than the 3 factual miles. It was another culture, another country. Knoxland had been built in the 1960s, apparently from papier-mâché and balsa wood. Walls so thin, you could hear the neighbours cutting their toenails and smell their dinner on the stove. Patches of damp bloomed on its grey concrete walls. Graffiti had turned the place into hard Knox. Other embellishments warned the packies to get out, while a scrawl that was probably only an hour or so old bore the legend, "One less." What shops there were had resorted to metal grills on windows and doors, not even bothering to remove them during opening hours. The place itself was contained, hemmed in by dual carriageways to north and west. The bright-eyed developers had scooped out subways beneath the roads. Probably in their original drawings, these had been clean, well-lit spaces where neighbours would stop to chat about the weather and the new curtains in the window of number 42. In reality, they'd become no-go areas for everyone but the foolhardy and suicidal, even in daytime. It was probably those same bright-eyed developers who'd had the idea of naming the estate's various high-rise blocks after Scottish writers, and appending each with the word house, serving merely to rub in that these were nothing like real houses. Barry House, Stevenson House, Scott House, Burns House, reaching skywards with all the subtlety of single-digit salutes. Rebus looked around for somewhere to deposit his half-empty coffee cup. He'd stopped at a baker's on Gorgie Road, knowing that the further from the city centre he drove, the less likely he would be to find anything remotely drinkable. Not a good choice. The coffee had been scalding at first, quickly turning tepid, which only served to highlight its lack of anything resembling flavour. There were no bins nearby. No bins at all, in fact. The pavements and grass verges, however, were doing their best to oblige. So Rebus added his litter to the mosaic, then straightened up and pushed his hands deep into his coat pockets. He could see his breath in the air.
Thanks a lot, Ian. I appreciate you reading such a lengthy passage, but I think that with that being the start of Flesh Market Alley, the reader who is new to the Inspector Rebus series is going to learn a lot about Edinburgh and Rebus in a relatively short period of time. And in any good crime series, the city in which the series takes place becomes a central character, and that certainly isn't the case of Edinburgh in your novel. And you mentioned some of the famous city fathers in that opening. And why don't you tell us a little bit about some of the references you've made? And this was from the 18th century in Scotland, some of these names.
Yeah, well, Knoxland itself, which is K-N-O-X, is named after a famous churchman and writer who was famously and ferociously anti-Catholic and anti-women and anti just about everything. He once wrote a pamphlet called The Monstrous Regiment of Women. He was a Calvinist. He was a kind of dark and dour sort of guy. And some of the city, I think, still has that characteristic to it. I mean, the writers, you know, you can't live in Edinburgh or have spent any time there as a writer and not be aware of your heritage. there, you know, you, as you arrive by train, you arrive at Waverley Station, named after the novel by Sir Walter Scott. As you come out of the station onto the main shopping street, you see the Scott Monument, named after Sir Walter Scott, a huge, towering, sort of missile-shaped thing. Everywhere you go, you see Robert Louis Stevenson's house from when he was a kid. You're aware that people like Scott and Stevenson, Robert Burns spent a lot of time there, and of course J.M. Barrie, who wrote Peter Pan, was also an Edinburgh writer, as was Sir Arthur Conan Doyle. We forget that, we tend to forget that, but he was born and grew up in Edinburgh. So I wanted to kind of flag that up, that Edinburgh is a place of culture. Now, of course, the clash then is with the city that Rebus tends to police, which of course is the city of the have-nots, the city of the losers, the down-and-outs, the dregs. Rebus doesn't always get to see what a beautiful city he lives in, because to him it's just a series of crime scenes waiting to happen.
Yes, and the literary history continues today, which is must be an exciting place to be living today. There, in addition to yourself, you have some other famous writers that are living there now, I believe. Isn't that correct?
Yeah, well, when I started writing books in Edinburgh about Edinburgh in the early 80s, there didn't seem to be anybody writing about Edinburgh, or indeed anybody writing in contemporary Edinburgh. The modern Edinburgh novel at that time was The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie by Muriel Spark, which was published in 1961 and set in the 1930s. Since then, since the 80s when I started writing, there's been an explosion of talent, and in the very street that I live in, I live two doors away from Alexander McCall Smith, the author of the number one ladies detective agency books. So he's two doors away, and at the top of our street and round the corner, literally a 2-minute walk, is J.K. Rowling's home. So you've got three writers within 100 yards of each other. And because of that, the area that I live in is now, the locals call it Writer's Block.
What's it like with J.K. Rowling right now? Is that kind of crazy living there right now? I mean, are there fans there in droves?
No, I mean, I think part of the reason why she continues to live in Edinburgh is that, you know, in Edinburgh you're allowed a measure of privacy. You could be Sean Connery walking down the main street and people would say, "Hey, how you doing, Sean?" But no one's really going to hassle you. She's had one stalker who had to be deported. It was an American woman. But apart from that, she keeps herself to herself. She comes into the local cafe. I see her in there occasionally. She has a quiet family life, and she manages to get a lot of writing done, which is great.
That's fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. One of the things I liked about Flesh Market Alley is you broke the book up into 10 days. And stylistically, when you started the novel, Ian, why did you decide that, or when did you decide that you would clearly delineate the days that that make up the story of Flesh Market Alley?
Several reasons. I mean, number one, by breaking it up into days, that just keeps me clear in my own mind, because it's quite easy to keep, you know, once you're on the roller coaster that is a twisting mystery plot, it's very easy to lose track of the days, and you find that you've got your detective working 7 days straight, which of course in reality they never would. You know, they're working through Saturday and Sunday, you just don't realise it's a Saturday or a Sunday. So breaking it up into days is useful for that. However, I never really plan these things in advance. I didn't plot the book out and say, okay, it's going to take place over 10 days and here's what's going to happen on each day. It just so happened that it took 10 days for the story to tell itself. So, I mean, it wasn't pre-plotted to that extent. It was just a useful way of me keeping track of what Rebus would be doing on any given day. And it's quite nice to have that kind of tight structure anyway. I mean, in reality, of course, we know that police investigations usually take a lot longer than that. But readers quite like it that it's contained in a short period of time. In previous books, you know, I've had books where it's only taken 5 or 6 or 7 days to wrap everything up, which readers seem to like. They like that kind of tight containment of time.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I enjoyed, too, about this was it. Rebus is one of the things I like about the Inspector Rebus series, and this is, I believe this is number 15 in the series, isn't it, Ian?
You would know better than me.
Okay, yeah, it's 15. Is you've allowed Rebus to age in the series, and Lawrence Block has done that with Matt Scudder, but not a lot of series writers allow their characters to age. And with Flesh Market Alley, I found it interesting. By the end of the day, Rebus is kind of tired, and Siobhan, his partner, who is almost gets equal billing in this book, To me, it was very. I could see how much that she cared for him and he for her, because she kind of knows when he's getting tired at the end of the day. And I thought that added a depth to the novel, because you realize that you're kind of tired in the morning and you do get worn out at night. And how do you end your days? I thought that added an element to the novel which I really enjoyed.
Well, this was a conscious decision on my part from very early on in the series. When I wrote the very first novel, Knots and Crosses, I had no idea it was the first book in a series. I'd written a novel before that was a standalone. I wrote Knots and Crosses. I went off and did a couple of thrillers, and I only slowly came back to Rebus because there were things about him that were still unsaid. He had got beneath my skin as a character. And by the time I was two or three books in, I suddenly realised, oh, this is a series now. At that point, I didn't think, okay, how many books am I going to write in the series? I had no set number. I just thought, as long as I can think of new things to find out about him and new things to say about Edinburgh, I will continue to write the books. However, having decided that he would live in real time, the clock was already ticking, and I'd made him 40 in the first novel, which means he's now up in his mid to late 50s, and I discovered that if you're a detective in Scotland, you have to retire at 60. So he's only really got a few more books, a few more years left in him, which may explain the prominence that is beginning to be given to Siobhan. Maybe she's my insurance policy, so that if and when he does retire, she can carry the series and he can be in the background doing all her dirty work, because he's no longer a cop. He can break as many rules as he likes.
I think that sounds great, and I think that her evolution as a character has been one of the most satisfying parts of the series over the last few books. She's really taken on a stronger presence in the books, and to me
I'm doing something a few writers of series ever do. At the moment, I'm rereading all my books in chronological order, never having done that. I mean, once I've written a book and it's published, usually that's the end of it. I'm on to the next project. But I'm writing a book I'm about to start writing a book called Rebus's Scotland, which is a non-fiction book, which is partly my autobiography, partly his biography, how I came to write the books, with lots of black, sort of atmospheric black and white photographs of locations used in the series. Now, to prepare for that, I've been reading the books in order, and what I find in the early books is that there are very few strong women characters, because I felt I wasn't confident about writing from a woman's perspective, and especially a woman cop. And then what happened was that women crime writers, people like Val McDermott and Ruth Rendell and others, would say, oh, hey, we like what you do with these characters. And so did women police officers. They started, they would come and get books signed and say, oh, we like Jill Templer, we like Siobhan Clark, are you going to do more with them? And so I started to grow a bit in confidence. And at the same time, Siobhan started life as just another colleague, just someone else that could be at Rebus's police station. But something about her, again, got beneath my skin and demanded that I explore her character more, because there's so much I can do with her. She's a woman in what is still thought of as a man's job. There's a glass ceiling there that she wants to break through. She's college educated, which Rebus isn't. She's computer literate, which Rebus isn't. He's a bit of a dinosaur. So the two of them spark off each other quite nicely. She's also got a Gaelic Celtic name, but she's got an English accent, so I can talk about racism and xenophobia in Scotland. So there's so much I can do with her. That she complements Rebus quite nicely.
Yes, absolutely. You mentioned a name there, Val McDermott, in